Let's gavel in. Let's call this meeting of House Health and Social Service Committee in to order. It is 3:33 p.m. on March 14th, 2013. Present are Representatives Pruitt, Representative Keller, Representative Reinbold, and myself, Representative Higgins. And I guess technically we have a quorum. So let the record reflect that we have a quorum. I would like to recognize the staff today. We have Butch Carver as the House Recording Secretary. The LIO moderator is Claire Gross. And my committee aide is Paul Verhagen. So if anybody needs anything, raise your hand. Paul will come get you and take care of your needs. Let's take care of our electronic devices. If they're on, if they ring, I have a standing rule. You owe me a donut or the whole committee. So let's try not to do that. Today, we're going to start off. We have a couple of confirmation hearings to begin with. We have a Kevin Lupin to serve on the State Medical Board and a Kathleen Millar to serve on the State Medical Board. It should be noted that signing the Confirmation Committee report does not reflect the intent of any member of this committee to vote for or against an individual in any other further sessions for this purpose of confirmation. Correct? Okay. All right, with that, we'll begin the hearing. The governor has appointed Kevin Lupin to the State Medical Board. Mr. Lupin, are you on the phone?
Yes, sir.
Okay, if you can put your name on the record and tell us your affiliation and tell us a little bit about yourself and why we should choose you to serve on the State Medical Board, the phone is yours.
Thank you. Yeah. My name is Kevin Lupin. I'm a physician assistant, have been for a little over 30 years. Came to Alaska with the Air Force in 1975 and have been here since, except to leave to go to school. I've worked in various areas of the state from the Aleutians to the North Slope, both with Native groups and with corporations. So I've got a pretty good broad background in various geographical locations, and then also the different organizations from Native to Corporation. Retired from BP a couple of years ago, and now with an organization in Anchorage that provides paramedics and PAs, physicians, to a lot of remote areas. I guess the reason for the interest on the medical board is one, having worked in the bush and seeing some of the quality issues with some of the providers. As PAs, it was a relatively young profession when I started. We had to prove ourselves over and over again, and I would like to kind of see that continue to make sure we have the quality medical delivery in the rural areas, as well as the remainder of the state. And that's sort of it in a synopsis.
Well, let the record reflect that Representative Tarr has joined us. Thank you. And Representative Reinbold has a question.
Hello. Thank you for your willingness to serve on this board. And I just want to ask a question. What do you think the biggest concern our future right now in Alaska for health care, and how do you plan on addressing it?
I think it's not only attracting but maintaining quality providers. There are, you know, constant challenges, certainly in the bush communities, to keep quality individuals out there. I know for a long time it was a lot of the issues were based on the length of the contracts and the lack of support and time off. I know that that's been addressed through some of the Native organizations on a rotational basis. So I think the key for that, one, is to make sure we continue to draw on the quality folks that we can, and one, to try to address how we can keep them on site, whether it's either rotational, whether it's support in any other fashion that we can to keep them there. But that's the big thing. Alaska, for a long time at the beginning, especially for mid-levels, the draw to the state was salary. Unfortunately, now it's equalized where Alaska doesn't lead in income, and so there are some challenges there as well to make sure that we can attract the right kind of people up north. So I think those are the biggest challenges, is one, to attract, two, to make sure that they're supported, and then three, to make sure that, you know, these are vetted and quality people to deliver health care in the rural areas.
Thank you.
Mr. Lupin, am I pronouncing your last name right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you. What was it that you've done with the state again? I mean, or you're working with the Native health organizations?
Yeah, when I first came out, it was in the Aleutians out in, I worked out in Sandpoint, King Cove, Cold Bay, and Dutch Harbor, so it was the eastern Aleutians region that I worked with. I've done some, you know, health support with South Central as well, and then working in the oil and gas industry. And then we also support a lot of different other industries in my current organization around the state.
So when you say you've worked with them in the health industry, I guess what exactly was that? I mean, what were you doing, and how long have you been doing that?
Yeah, it was primarily out in the Aleutians, was primarily as a provider, but it was also helping with the local health boards and other organizations to try to get the best healthcare system delivery that we could out there. So it was mostly with the local health boards, although with the Eastern Aleutian corporations also assisted with them as well.
Okay. So are you a doctor?
No, a physician assistant.
A physician assistant. Okay. That's what I was
yep.
trying to get. Okay. Are you licensed in the state of Alaska?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Answered all my questions. Anybody else? Any other questions? Nope. Representative Keller?
Yeah, just thanks for being willing to serve. Appreciate it. And you're looking over your resume. You have a very interesting background. You've been around. And just grateful that you're there to be willing to spend this time. So just thanks.
I thank you.
We thank you for everything you've done. Any more questions from the committee? Good. Well, with that, then, if there's is there any public testimony on the appointment of Mr. Lupin? I hear no public testimony. And there's no other further questions from the committee. May I have a motion to move Mr. Lupin's name from the committee and from the committee and onto the full legislation for confirmation?
Mr. Chairman, I so move to for the appointment.
Okay. Good. So with that, then I guess Mr. Lupin, your name will be forwarded to the full legislation for confirmation. Thank you for your time. And since this is my first time doing this, I guess is that. You'll hear from us again. Is that how it works,
Mr. Chairman?
Yep. Go ahead.
Thank you.
Representative Seaton, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Thank you. Just for Mr. Lupin's clarification, you know, we've reviewed his qualifications,
right.
And we're forwarded to him for consideration by a joint session. But there's nothing in that forwarding that either supports or opposes his confirmation. We've reviewed his.
Right.
Just for everybody's information.
Right. We went through that.
You did. Okay. Thank you. Sorry.
That's okay. That's all right. Once again, thank you, Mr. Lupin, for your time.
Thank you very much.
All right. Now, let's move on to our second confirmation, and that's going to be the governor has appointed, is it Kathleen Millar? Is that correct? Or is it Casey?
Yeah, it's Casey.
Keep telling me Casey.
You by, but Kathleen is what you probably have in front of you. So.
Is Kathleen your given name, or is it Casey?
Both are, and I go by Casey more than I do Kathleen.
So. Okay. Well, we'll call you Casey then.
Okay, great.
Okay.
Perfect.
Thanks. All right. Mrs. Millar, please put your name on the record and tell us about yourself and why you chose to serve on the state medical board.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kathleen Casey Millar, and I chose to serve on the board through a suggestion from a physician that had been on the board suggested that I would probably like it and be able to add something to the table. So I did put my name in the hat and was appointed, thankfully, because it's been a great experience. It's a weighty experience. It's, you know, we deal with some far-reaching decisions, but I think it's very important to have a public member on the board. I'm really thankful to be there, and I think it's really important to have some longevity, so that's why I'm willing to do a second term.
Okay. All right, we have a couple of questions from the committee. Representative Reinbold.
Casey, I have a quick question for you. It looks like you right now you're currently employed at the Anchorage School District under student nutrition. Is that correct?
No, I am no longer with the student nutrition department. I've opened up a shop in Anchorage, a store, and I am full-time doing that.
Okay, if you don't...
I was there for 5 years, so if you have a question about that, I'd be happy to answer that.
She does.
Yes, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Okay, so Casey, basically, I have a real problem with some of the nutrition in our schools. I've been subbing in them the last 10 years, and I have a hard time eating the food that's in our cafeterias. And when I grew up here and I went to public school, we had home-cooked meals. And when I took my kids over to private school over in Norway, they had home-cooked meals. And I just don't understand why we don't have more emphasis on fresh, good quality food in our cafeterias in our schools. So can you tell me, was that a frustration for you? Were you able to make progress? What do you think about the food that we serve our kids in our and I can in particularly talk about Anchorage right now.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. It was a constant frustration. I think it boiled down to the fact that, you know, the food that is served in the schools is somewhat of a government subsidy, and so it is a little bit out of the control of the individual schools, unless they are a private school, to have much control over what the menu says. It has gotten better. They did take out the soda machines and put in, you know, water and some, I think, some energy drinks, of not the ones that have a lot of stuff in them, but, you know, more vitamin energy drinks. So things, I saw improvement. I see now that they are doing fresh vegetables on certain days, especially in the provisional schools, which have children that cannot afford the lunch program. Most of them are not able to afford. So it's a provisional school where they're provided the meal free of charge, and they have gotten better with fresh vegetables, fresh fruits, and those kinds of things offered every day. So there have been improvements made. We have a long way to go. And you're right, it's horrible. What we're feeding our kids is bad.
Thank you. Hold on. I have a question, if Mrs. Millar. As a public member on the board, State Medical Board, this is going to be your second term, is that correct?
That is correct. Mm-hmm.
On your first term, how did it go for you? How many times did you guys meet?
We meet 4 times a year. And we sometimes have teleconferences in between if there's a matter that needs to be addressed because of public safety or some other matter that, you know, a licensing issue or something that needs to be addressed for the sake of time, not wanting it to wait maybe till the meeting. So at first I felt like a fish out of water, of course, and that's why I believe in the longevity, because it takes a while to get up to speed. You know, my only medical background was using the medical community as in raising 5 children. So I spent, you know, a considerable amount of time at some physician's office over the years. But, you know, it was from that perspective, not from the, you know, medical standpoint. And many of the things that we, understanding the medical standpoint, many of the things that we do talk about, of course, have a lot of medical jargon and a lot of medical terms, things like that, that take a while for you to get up to speed. Mm-hmm. The docs on the board are more than gracious and willing to help in any which way that they can, and no question was ever unanswered for me, or, you know, I felt like every question was important, which is really great. We have some wonderful people serving on the board. But again, I will say that longevity is important because we have issues that are spanning, you know, from before I got on the board to we're still dealing with them now. They span many, many years sometimes. Right. So to have some history of what had happened is really valuable.
Well, thank you. You've answered my question. I was just curious on how the board, as a public member, if they helped educate you on some of the matters that were coming, and you said they did, and that's great.
Yeah, they really
did.
And the other thing that's helpful is there's a national board, the FSMB, Federation of State Medical Boards, which has a actual, they meet, I think, once a year, and you can go to a conference which has a breakout session for public members, which was probably one of the most valuable things I did early on because it gave me a better feel of exactly what does a public member do and what am I responsible for. So that was very important, and we participate in that every year, the Alaska State Medical Board does.
Okay. I know that Representative Reinbold, I think you wanted to follow up or something. I'm sorry.
Sure. Just to revert back just a little bit, it just seems to me, and I know what you're out of the position now, so maybe it's maybe you'll have influence or have a suggestion for us, but it just seems like if they have home ec, you know, or culinary arts or something in the schools, that they should be able to help, you know, cook for these kids fresh, making soup and salad and things like that, that is so much more tolerable than them racing, you know, in my case, to Tocatinu Commons or McDonald's for lunch, if we provide better and healthier food in the schools. I'm just not sure if you have a suggestion on that. I don't mean to be diverting. I'm just trying to.
I think it's a valid issue. I think it has, you know, I mean, it's valid in health, and health is, you know, important to all of us. And I agree with you. And, you know, the UAA has a culinary department that does just that. They have a place on campus that provides meals and as well as teaching people how to cook and how to maybe go into that field. They also offer those meals as, you know, you can go in and have them and purchase them, which would be a great idea. If we have a culinary department in the high schools, that's exactly what they could be doing and should be doing, and it is a fabulous idea. There are ways to do it that would be cost effective, I'm sure. It's just that we're in a bit of a rut. But the more that it's brought up and the more attention that's brought to the lack of nutrition that's in the food that they're being served now is the best way to bring new ideas to light and get someone that's passionate, like you sound like you are, about making a change in those areas, because it affects everybody. It affects their whole health for the rest of their life.
Yeah. Are there any other questions from the committee? Representative Tarr?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. thank you, Ms. Millar. I just wanted to ask, one of the community service activities that you list is volunteer hosting weekly staff meetings at Young Life Alaska. I was unfamiliar with that organization, so in trying to learn a little bit more about that, described as an evangelical Christian ministry, and found some information about some what I think could be considered fairly controversial practices by the organization in terms of requirements of staff and the statement of non-negotiables, and something I found right around the time of your original application. So I just wanted to see if you're still volunteering with this organization and if you feel like you can serve with in an unbiased way. I think, you know, as a person of faith myself, sometimes that can be hard, but just wondered if you could comment on that, please.
I'm involved with Young Life in the fact that my son is the area director for Anchorage. And if you would like to speak offline again more about that, if there's some issue that you see that you could think might be a conflict, I don't see how there would might be any conflict or having any it would affect the judgment of mine in any way that would be adverse to the health and medical community. I'm sure glad to help answer any question. If you could be more specific, I could help to answer that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sure, I just wanted to get some feedback about that, and maybe I can pursue this in a separate conversation and learn a little bit more, because I'm just going off of what's online. But we know there are difficult decisions that come before the State Medical Board, and so wanted to give you the opportunity to just say that in public, that you didn't think there were any conflicts, and That certainly helps me.
No, I don't see how there could be. And again, you know, it is a voting board, and I am one voice. And so, you know, there it is.
Okay. Representative Reinbold?
Yes. Did your son happen to be Trevor Millar?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. I hadn't put the two and two together. He is a fabulous individual and has been an incredible role model to my son. And I'm very enthusiastic about Young Life and think it's one of the best things going in our high school. So thank you.
Great.
Thank you for serving on that as well.
Well, glad to hear it. I'm glad it's positive. Thank you.
Are there any other questions from the committee? Okay. Is there any public testimony on the appointment of Ms. Millar? And there's no further questions. Let's see here. Is there any further discussion on the appointment of Ms. Millar to the State Medical Board? Hearing none, may I have a motion to move Ms. Millar's name from the committee and on to the full legislature for confirmation?
Mr. Chair, I'll make the motion that we move Casey Millar's name up to the full body for her confirmation. Thank you.
Hearing no no objections, Casey Millar, your name will be forwarded to the full legislation for confirmation. And at that point, we'll take a brief at ease while we get the our next presentation ready. We're back in order. I know it's been kind of a hectic day today with the session, and I know today we have one presentation on the Affordable Care Act, and I was told that you could do 2 hours easily on that. Unfortunately, you have 1 hour. So with that, our presenters will put themselves while you're at the table. If you just give us your names and your affiliation, and you can begin your presentation. And now when we talked earlier, you would want us to hold our questions until sort of towards the end, right? Is that, or do you want us to ask questions as we go?
Mr. Chair, if I could, I would request that we hold questions because I am just dying to hear what they have to say, and I've heard it 3 or 4 or 5 times. And I want them to get through it and not get on any rabbit trail so we get the big picture, if that's okay.
No, that's fine. We kind of discussed that, but that was before our day kind of went out of here, so I didn't know if we still wanted to stay to that script. But that sounds good to me. We can hold our questions until when you guys feel it's appropriate, but please leave a few minutes of time for us to ask some questions, because I know we all have questions as we go. So kind of keep that in the back of your minds. Okay? All right. Let's begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Deb Erickson. I'm the director of the Alaska Healthcare Commission. What we've actually done is we've shortened this presentation somewhat, even from the handout that you received a couple of days ago. We cut a number of the slides out, understanding that there were going to be some time constraints. And in the interest of time, I'm going to go through them very quickly to hit some of the highlights from the Affordable Care Act. As staff to the Healthcare Commission, I really am not in a position to represent the agency, the Department of Health and Social Services and Administration, and some of the activities that they've undertaken and the decisions they're making. So at that point, I'll turn it over to Mr. Appleby to answer any questions that you might have regarding where the state is at in terms of implementation or interpretation of any of the given provisions in the act. So you want to go ahead and move?
Yeah, absolutely. And for the record, Mr. Chairman, my name is Josh Appleby. I'm the Deputy Director for Healthcare Policy for the Department of Health and Social Services. And I think going through the presentation and holding the questions for the end would probably be the best way to go.
Thank you. So I'll just go ahead and get started. And first, just wanted to touch on something that might be a little bit basic, but understanding that some of you might not be as steeped in following what's going on with the federal health care reform, wanted to just make sure you understand that I think most people get their information through the popular media, and you might hear various terminology referred to either the formal title of the act, which is the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. Most people shorten it to the Affordable Care Act. And even in formal news reports, you sometimes hear it referred to as Obamacare. But either those who embrace it and appreciate the new law or those who don't appreciate it as much. But that we're talking about, when we talk about the Patient Protection Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, the same thing, which is essentially the one major law that was enacted back in March of 2010 and a couple of laws that have been passed soon after to make some amendments to that. The overview of the act, there are 10 different titles to it, and one of the other things you may have heard is that it really is not as much about health care reform as it is about health insurance reform, and most of the major provisions really are addressing health care coverage and trying to expand access to health care insurance. But there are titles that address things such as prevention of public health, addressing workforce issues, fraud and abuse. I've cut some of those slides out and some of those details, and we're going to focus on some of the real major functional pieces. But we have more information about provisions in those other sections of the law as well, if you're interested in additional information. And just for a quick graphic on how the law is structured and how it is attempting to achieve increased health insurance coverage for the general population is through a number of different types of strategies. There are a series of private insurance market reforms included in the act, as well as some new insurance programs that are created through the act. There are the individual mandate and the employer mandate, which requires that individuals have insurance or that employers provide insurance, and then a series of subsidies for individuals who might be low income and for some small businesses to help with paying for insurance. There's the health insurance exchange, intended to provide kind of an electronic marketplace for shopping for and purchasing insurance, and also providing some of the subsidies for insurance, and then also the Medicaid expansion. So those are the kind of the main components that I'm going to try to cover real quickly right now. The individual mandate requires that all individuals must have a qualified health plan or pay a tax penalty. And that tax penalty, this requirement, takes effect for the 2014 tax year, and it is phased in over a period of 3 years, starting at $95 per person per year, or 1% of the household income, whichever is greater. And that increases to, by 2016, $695 per person per year, or 2.5% of household income, whichever is greater. And I'm skipping over a lot of the details, just so you understand. This requirement applies to children. The children's penalty is half the adult penalty. There's a cap on family. So again, just so you understand, there are a lot of details behind some of these highlights I'm trying to hit. It's also important to understand, though, that there are exemptions to this requirement. And just some examples of that, there's a religious exemption. Folks who hold a religious belief that would be counter to owning health insurance are not required to comply. American Indians and Alaska Natives are exempt from this provision of the act. I think there's an assumption that access to Indian Health Service benefits is, in effect, health insurance coverage. There's financial hardship and some other provisions related to financial ability to afford insurance that also are included in those exemptions, as well as Medicare and TRICARE. There are also then subsidies, some federal funding available for low-income folks between 133% of poverty, federal poverty level, and 400% of federal poverty level to assist with purchasing insurance. They come in the form of tax credits that can be advanceable and available through the insurance exchange. And the amount that's available of the subsidy varies by region and varies based on income levels. The employer mandate applies to businesses that have 50 or more full-time employees, and the IRS has already defined for this particular provision that full-time equivalent would be an employee who works an average of 30 hours or more a week. And so businesses that have 50 or more full-time employees are subject to the mandate. It's important, I think, for businesses to understand, though, too, that this requirement, the penalty that's associated with it, applies can potentially apply to a business that does provide insurance. The way that this provision is worded is that if the employer does not offer coverage, they are required to pay $2,000 per full-time employee per year. That's with the first 30 employees exempted. But that's only if one or more of their employees receives a subsidy through the exchange. But that also applies to a business that would provide health insurance coverage. One of the things I didn't mention with the subsidy that's available for individuals is that they would not be, an individual is not eligible for a subsidy if they have insurance coverage available through their employer and it meets certain standards. So it has to be 60% of the actuarial value. It can't cost them, their share of the premium can't cost them more than 9.5% of their household income. So if those standards aren't met and an employee is able to receive a subsidy through the exchange, regardless of whether the employer has provided some sort of coverage or not, they're potentially subject to some penalty here. And there also is a subsidy available for the very small businesses, businesses that have 25 or fewer full-time employees. And there are a number of caveats with that as well. I think one of the other things I might mention at this point is it's real important for employers to understand that different provisions of the Affordable Care Act apply in different ways depending on the size of the business, and those cutoffs are different for all different provisions. So there's the 50 full-time employees requirement for the mandate, 25 per full-time employee equipped for the receiving the tax credit. There's another rule for employers that have 200 employees for automatically enrolling new employees in insurance coverage if they offer it. There's another cutoff for 250 employees for being required to report on W-2 starting this year. So those are just some examples. Another cutoff is 100 employees, and that's for purchasing insurance through the health insurance exchange. So the health insurance exchange is meant to be a new electronic marketplace, again, for purchasing insurance. They are state-based. There's to be an individual electronic site for each individual state. There is an option provided in the law for multiple states to band together in putting a health insurance exchange together. There is an opt-out. The law anticipates that states will take advantage of federal resources for planning and setting up an insurance exchange for their state, but there's an opt-out provision that requires the Secretary of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services to establish a federal exchange for states where the state government is not going to be setting up that, that requirement. The insurance exchange is to be operational for the calendar year 2014, actually needs to be operational by October of this year in order to start enrolling folks for the new calendar year. There's a requirement that the exchanges have an interface with the state Medicaid program for eligibility and enrollment. It's only, again, available in the first 3 years for individuals and for the small group market for small employers of fewer than 100 full-time employees. Large businesses will be allowed to start participating in 2017. And then one other thing I wanted to note is that there's a requirement in the law that the insurance exchanges be self-sustaining by 2015. The Medicaid expansion under the law initially was meant to be a mandate for states would be required to expand their Medicaid programs, eligibility for those programs for everyone up to 133% of the federal poverty level. And I've thrown in a little footnote about that, that there's a 5% income disregard, because you might sometimes see this requirement noted as 138% of the federal poverty level rather than 133%, and that's because provision related to eligibility determination requires that 5% of income be disregarded, essentially. So in effect, it makes that cutoff 138% rather than 133%. The federal government will pay the full amount, 100% of the medical claims portion of that until 2017, and then the state government's participation is phased in up to a maximum of 10% starting in that year, the maximum hitting in the year 2020. And then with the Supreme Court decision this past summer, one of the issues that the state brought, the states that participated, including Alaska in that lawsuit, was that it was overly coercive on the part of the federal government to require states to either expand their Medicaid program or discontinue participation in Medicaid at all. The Supreme Court found in favor of the states in that lawsuit, and the result was that they made the Medicaid expansion an option for states to choose. The federal government issued guidance to states back in December to clarify that under this new option now that a partial expansion is not allowed, but that there's no deadline for making a decision about the expansion, and also that there would be an option for discontinuing at some point in the future if a state chooses to expand, that they might choose to rescind that at some point in the future. One other thing I wanted to note about the Medicaid expansion that I think is real important to understand, too, at least from the state government's perspective, is that the law makes a real significant change to the methodology for determining eligibility. It shifts to modified adjusted gross income eligibility determination. It's a significant change from the way states determine eligibility now. And so it will have a significant impact on state Medicaid programs to make that the procedural and programmatic shift around that. And it applies to the whole Medicaid program starting in 2014, not just the expansion population, and not just if a state chooses to participate in that option or not. And then also state Medicaid programs are required to coordinate eligibility determination through the insurance exchange. A few other provisions I wanted to touch on that are significant and I think will be really important to track over time are provisions that are intended to drive reform in the way healthcare services are delivered through paying for healthcare services in a different way, titled a payment reform. There are quite a number of these, and these provisions, and many, if not most of them, are driving through making changes through the way Medicare services are paid for. There are a couple of demonstration projects for Medicaid programs to participate if they're interested in them. There are also a couple of initiatives that are multi-payer initiatives that are encouraging states to partner the Medicaid program with the Medicare program with private insurance companies to work together on some essentially experiments with paying for healthcare in a different way. And their payment reforms are trying to drive the usual fee-for-service mechanism towards paying for services more globally, focusing on paying more for outcomes and for value rather than paying for individual services. There are a number of different ways in which the Affordable Care Act pays for itself. There's a series of savings through those payment reform provisions, the fraud and abuse and new program integrity provisions. There are, I put in quote, cuts, rate cuts. There are some limitations imposed on the extent to which Medicare rates can increase. There are also a series of new taxes and fees, and most of those new taxes and fees are taking effect in this current tax year, the 2013. The first took effect in 2010. It was a new 10% excise tax on indoor tanning. And then during 2012, a new fee imposed on the pharmaceutical industry that's intended to generate $2.8 billion in new federal revenues through the pharmaceutical industry was imposed. This year, a new 2.3% sales tax on certain medical devices takes effect. A new Medicare payroll tax increase is taking effect, increasing just the individual's contribution, and just for high-income individuals, those making $200,000 or more a year. There's a new Medicare tax, again, on those same high-income levels for unearned income, and 3.8%. And there's also a new fee that will take effect next year on the health insurance industry that will, in the first year, generate $8 billion in annual revenue for the federal government. And then finally, I'll note, especially it's a ways out, but this is one of the latest provisions. And I think it's important to understand, too, that this law has provisions that some of which took effect immediately when it passed in 2010. The furthest out will take effect until the year 2018. And one of those you may have heard referred to as the Cadillac tax, but it's a new tax that will be imposed in the year 2018 on employer-sponsored insurance that is more than a certain value, high value. The Healthcare Commission contracted with ICER after the bill passed, so I wanted to note a couple of things. I included just a very general summary of the kind of high-level economic impact. This was calculated 2 years ago. It was based on the Medicaid expansion being mandatory, and these changes that are noted here are net changes, so you can't see without looking at the more detailed report how all of the individual changes in new revenue for the federal government is offsetting new expanded payment by the federal government. So, for example, the increased health care spending net by the federal government of $124 million, you can't see that behind that the federal government will actually be spending with the Medicaid expansion as much as $700 million more dollars in Alaska. We'll be taking in $500 million more in taxes from Alaska through the variety of taxes that I listed there. And then it takes into consideration some of the savings and that sort of thing. So I just wanted to make sure you understood that this is net, and it's kind of covering up some details that you might think are a lot more important that we could pull out for you from that report. And again, that might be a little bit outdated at this point. Just to note a few things, too, about the legal challenges and some of the political and budgetary realities related to implementation of the law at this point. The Supreme Court ruling this past summer was significant, especially in that it upheld the constitutionality of the individual mandate, which was part of the challenges, based on federal government's power to tax. But then limited the Medicaid expansion and made it an option for states. And I have used this slide with a picture of Minnesota and Wisconsin just to illustrate and to tell a story about the state government's role in implementing the Affordable Care Act, because I think it's important, especially before the Supreme Court ruling, if the Affordable Care Act is federal law, it's the law of the land, the state government's really didn't, except now for the Medicaid expansion, have any role in deciding whether it was going to be implemented in their state or not, but they had played a very significant role in deciding how it might be implemented. But now with the Medicaid expansion option on that one piece, and very significant piece, state governments obviously do have a more significant role in if that provision will be implemented. And the story about Minnesota and Wisconsin is that when the law passed in March of 2010, Governor Pawlenty was the governor of Minnesota, Republican governor. Governor Dooley in Wisconsin was a Democrat. Within 2 weeks of the law being enacted, Governor Dooley issued an executive order creating a new state government agency to implement the federal reform, the Affordable Care Act. And within a couple of weeks of that, Governor Pawlenty issued an executive order prohibiting state agencies from participating in any of the state government opportunities to receive grant funding and to participate in planning for implementation of provisions in the Act. that November then, with the elections in November of 2010, the governor's parties for either of those two states switched. Democrat came in as the governor of Minnesota, Republican came in as the governor of Wisconsin, and immediately overturned those executive orders, and you just saw that those state governments' approaches switch literally overnight to participating. And so especially just for the general public, I think it's important to understand that the political landscape in a given state can determine somewhat how the Affordable Care Act might be implemented in their state. A couple of points about federal budget constraints as well. Some of the deals and provisions that have taken effect just recently, the fiscal cliff deal that passed on January 1st, and then the sequester that took effect just on March 1st, is having some effect on the Affordable Care Act. There were two significant things that happened with the fiscal cliff deal. One, there had been $5 billion appropriated under the law to create the co-op program, which is a consumer-operated and oriented health insurance plan, essentially created new nonprofit health insurance programs that would be member-run and operated and provided low-interest loans for those new nonprofits to set up these new health plans. All of the available funding that hadn't been awarded yet was eliminated. And then one of the titles of the act, the CLASS Act, which created a new public long-term care insurance program, was repealed in the fiscal cliff deal. And then there are quite a few provisions affecting the healthcare industry in general, not just Affordable Care Act funding, but I've just noted the Affordable Care Act funding specifically that's impacted and the extent to which it's impacted in the sequester. Just as some examples. I'm not going to go over these in detail, but just a few highlights of federal government's implementation to date. There have been a number of new federal government offices and boards and commissions and committees established. I could probably call it a flood of government regulations and guidance that has been coming out. I think I imagine for the healthcare provider industry, as I know for state governments, it feels a bit like drinking from a fire hose, the volume of additional rules that are coming out of the federal government for how they're implementing the law, and quite a few grants from a variety of different programs have been awarded as well. And the next two or three slides I just put up as examples. For each of the commission's quarterly meetings, I've been preparing a summary of some of the major things that have changed or been implemented in just the previous 3 months since the commission had met again. And so these are just some examples from our last meeting, which was just last week, that I was sharing with them about the impact on the fiscal cliff deal on the insurance co-ops and how that might have affected Alaska specifically, where we did have a group that had applied for one of those loans on December 31st only to have the program cut the next day. The high risk pool, I didn't describe this new program as a temporary program that was set up, but though that program was discontinued because it ran out of funding. There was $5 billion appropriated for that program as well. It was intended to go through the end of this calendar year, but they've just discontinued accepting new enrollee applications because they've run out of money. There's another slide that's just provided kind of the scorecard of where states are at in terms of participating in the health insurance exchange and their decisions related to the Medicaid expansion as of just the past week or two. And I'm certainly not going to go over this slide in any detail. I don't think I've ever put so many words on a slide. But I had just noted for the commission and wanted to share with all of you the variety of proposed and final regulation packages that have come out and guidance documents that have come out. And these vary. I think the longest of these is as long as 500 pages, and it's something that the state's trying to absorb. And the timeline, just some of the highlights related to this, there were a number, especially around the private insurance market reforms. A number of those were implemented in the first year, and the planning activities and grants started coming out almost immediately when the law was passed. But some of those major kind of cornerstones of the expansion pieces, the Medicaid expansion, the health insurance exchange, and the mandates and subsidies take effect in 2014. And again, the additional provisions will take effect in later years out until 2018. And with that, I will wrap up and turn the mic over to Josh to answer any questions you might have about how the Department of Health and Social Services is addressing these changes at this point.
Well, that was fast. And I know everybody at this table has got questions. So, in the interest of time, I think we're going to start at that end, because I know Representative Seaton was giving me an eye. I know we had some questions coming your way, so I think we'll start at that end, and let's all remember that we all have questions, so we're just going to work our way around. Okay, there you go. And then we'll start all over again, and hopefully we'll answer our own questions as we go. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'm just trying to figure out the dimensions here are really insurance. It's not so much dealing with health care. I noticed there's a prevention and public health title, but we didn't mention anything in that. So has the commission emphasis all been on access and payment instead of health?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, the commission's been attempting to track all of the different provisions. If available on the commission's website is a much more detailed overview of the act, and it also includes four provisions where we've noted that the state has participated in grants, or also there are quite a few of those grant programs are actually available to healthcare provider organizations and to the university, not just to state government. And so we have a note regarding how much money healthcare industry and specific organizations have received in grants from the Affordable Care Act. And some of those are public health and prevention initiatives as well.
Okay, and that's what I was wanting to follow up on, was just how much, I mean, it seems like the Affordable Care Act and everything we've been doing is simply on paying for access. And so it's on the website where there might be something where we're actually talking about health instead of just access to care. Is that correct?
Specific to the, through the chair, Representative Seaton, specific to the Affordable Care Act, this same presentation, but with all of those missing pieces filled in, and also so an overview of those other provisions that are included in the Affordable Care Act are there, as well as more detailed information about Alaska implementation specific to those provisions.
Okay, thank you.
Also, Mr. Chairman, again, for the record, Josh Appleby, we have several of our divisions within the department focused on different areas of the Affordable Care Act. Yes, the insurance exchanges falls within another department and falls into the Division of Insurance, and they've really stepped up their involvement and their focus on how that's shaping up. But all of the different sections of the Affordable Care Act are being watched and followed by the department.
Representative Rambold.
Okay, I could probably spend an hour asking questions just on one page, but I'll be respectful and start at the top, and then next time around I'll ask the next one. But on the new fees and taxes, it says $2.8 billion annual fee on the pharmaceutical industry increasing over time. Can you explain that?
Representative Rambold, through the chair, I think what you're asking is for the federal government's intent, and certainly I wouldn't dare guess at their intent of increasing taxes on any particular industry over time. But the fact of the matter is they're going to have to pay for this act somehow. And they've given themselves the ability, and knowing how costs are going to increase over time, they've certainly given themselves the ability to bring those taxes up to a level where they need to pay for this.
Follow up.
And in all fairness, driving the cost just ends up spreading it around more. So to me, I mean, this seems 100% illogical. And how are they going to pick and choose to collect this increasing fee, you know, just on pharmaceuticals. It seems to be driving the costs up and making them almost unaffordable.
Mr. Chairman, I think several people would agree that the rising cost of health care is the number one concern. Access and the ability to deliver the right care at the right time is there, but an unsustainable growth cost is always a concern.
Representative Pruitt.
Right down. So I'm going to stay on the same slide, and there I'm
sorry, going somewhere with this. So I want to make sure that 10% sales tax on indoor tanning. How much did they bring in? And was it what they expected to bring in?
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, and I'm going to say this phrase a lot, and I hope you don't take offense to it. We don't know.
Okay.
The implementation of the act is still very much in the early stages, and so numbers like that and plans moving forward, I think, is one of those questions that we're eager to find the answer to, and it'll certainly make our ability to implement the act and follow the law appropriately easier the more we know. And the reality of the fact is that there's a lot that we still don't know, and we're still looking for answers, and it gets frustrating.
So follow-up on that. Thank you for that. I appreciate and recognize that you're in a very difficult situation there. But I'm just expressing my concern over the fact that there's a lot of assumptions made by the federal government by putting this in on amounts of money that potentially will pay for this thing. And if you then go down two other slides to the Alaska impact in 2019, you have health care spending, state of Alaska, $41 million, Alaska households, $124 million, and then there's that federal government piece, that $142 million. And that concerns me because I think there's so many guesses that have been made on how much funds that $124 million right there, these days, we should expect as a state, we're going to have to be filling some of that bill. And so that's why I'm how do we prepare for in the future looking forward and making sure, I mean, we just you know, dealing with our operating budget today, obviously. How do we make sure that we're set on the funding aspect well into the future to provide what's essentially going to be required of us, unfunded mandate, essentially?
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, I think that's really the crux of a lot of the decision-making that's going on both within the department and throughout the state government as a whole, because we just don't know what the funding levels are going to be in the future. We don't know if that federal share is going to be there in the future. We're promised that it's going to be there, but we just don't know.
Yeah.
That's the answer.
That's our struggle. Yeah.
All right, my turn. All right, mine's kind of two questions, but hopefully they're really easy for you. One of them is we're going to clear the air right now, so everybody in the committee understands. The governor had said earlier that he was not going to do Medicaid expansion. That was in the newspaper. Apparently, that's incorrect, and you're going to explain that to us. And the other question I got is, and a lot of people ask me, what is Medicaid expansion? What exactly are you talking about?
Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate the opportunity to clarify. In a press conference on the 28th of February, the governor stated that he is not submitting to the legislature any plans concerning Medicaid expansion, and that the next decision point that he sees in regards to this issue is his budget submittal at the end of the year on December 15th. And so our department has been very busy in trying to get our head around what Medicaid expansion means in the state, what it means in terms of services provided, what it means in terms of dollars out, dollars saved. The calculus ranges from the fiscal to the political and everywhere in between. And so our commissioner has been very straightforward in every presentation that he's made. This is a decision that he wants to get right. And it's not a decision that's going to be made tomorrow, and it's not going to be a decision that's going to be made quickly or rashly. And so we're going to take the time to get it right. And we're very thankful that that we can kind of set that time frame, because everybody wanted to know when is the decision going to be made, when is the decision going to be made, and they wanted to know if it was going to be made this week or next week, and it's just not that simple. It's not a simple answer. It's not a no-brainer. It's one that's going to take a lot of analysis and a lot of time and consideration. But in regards to what Medicaid expansion is, under the Affordable Care Act, the expansion of Medicaid means providing Medicaid services to people, bringing the income level, what we call the federal poverty level, the FPL. I know we love our acronyms in the health and social services. But the federal poverty level from the different levels where it is now up to, as Deb put it, 138% of the federal poverty level. So anybody that makes that amount of money and below would be covered by Medicaid. And it would be everybody, not just women, not just pregnant women, not just families with children, but everybody. And so when we look at the expanded population, or what we call the newly eligible population, these are people who are not eligible and not enrolled in Medicaid today who would be under an expansion scenario. We also refer to people, a different group of people, we call them the woodwork effect. And those are people who are eligible for Medicaid today but are not enrolled, but who are going to enroll when they find out through a variety of communication blitzes and, hey, there's this new program out there. It's being expanded. It's called Medicaid. And you go in and you apply online, or you talk to somebody on the telephone and they fill out an application and they say, you know, you qualify, but you also would have qualified before, but you never applied. We call that the woodwork effect. These are people who come out of the woodwork and apply and were eligible. The difference between those two groups, Mr. Chairman, is that your newly eligible population will be covered by the federal government at 100%. The woodwork effect will be covered under the current participation rate, which is about 50%. So it's important to understand that Medicaid expansion combines both of these groups, the woodwork effect group and the newly eligible group.
Did you want to follow up on that one?
If I could, just to clarify that the woodwork, coming out of the woodwork effect would be pregnant women that hadn't applied, or children under CHIP. It wouldn't be adults, right? Because they're not covered now. So the adults would all be under, other than pregnant women with children, would all be covered under the 100%. Is that correct?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, yeah, you are correct. It's those individuals who would qualify today versus the people who would qualify under the expansion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kelly.
I've had about 10 questions circulating in my brain. It's hard to narrow down. But as I understood, now with this court decision, the Medicaid expansion, there is no deadline. That's first of all, I just want to confirm that. I mean, it's there and it will be there, and you know, as long as this program exists.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Keller, of course, the only thing that changes, when the Supreme Court made the decision optional, a lot of people were concerned that there was all of a sudden a deadline and they had to choose one way or the other. But it's been made very clear that there is no deadline. There's no drop-dead date that states can expand, and after a certain point, they won't be able to. What they do give up is if they don't expand beginning January 1, 2014, that 100% reimbursement only lasts for 3 years. It doesn't start from 3 years after you've made the decision. It's just 2014, 2015, 2016.
Okay.
So if you take 2 years to make a decision, you've foregone those 2 years at 100%. There's only 1 year left.
Okay.
Follow up?
This is kind of a follow up, but if you like, just one more. You made the comment that we now have the option of rescinding this even if we accepted it. That's in the context of the fact that right now we can't take part of our Medicaid and rescind it. I mean, we would take a dollar, we take it all, like it or not, you know. And my question is kind of convoluted, but I was wondering, is there more talk about block grants coming to the states as an option ultimately out of this? I mean, is that a lost issue now? It just seems to me like we take all this money. If we had it as a state, we are fully capable of figuring out who needs it. In fact, we're far more capable of figuring out who needs it than the federal regulations that are going to come from afar, you know. So is this waiver idea completely dead? Is there options? If we tried, if we expand to 138%, then all these new people in the system, yeah, we have the option to rescind maybe legally, politically. Wow. You know, I mean, no, not really. There's no option to rescind, you know, and not from a legislative perspective, you know. But the real intent of my question is there any hopes of this ever getting to the point where the state has more control over the money that is coming our way?
Representative Keller, to the chair, the Supreme Court decision to make Medicaid optional has raised the profile of block grants to pay for entitlement programs like Medicaid to the states. You will see in most recently as budget plans coming out of Congress that include that as an option. And it's always been in the discussion, certainly in think tanks and other groups. But the fact that states are now looking at this and its optional nature, I think, has really raised that profile and has brought those sort of issues to the forefront, certainly on a national level. I don't know about the probability of us getting there, but right. I think it's definitely been part of the conversation.
Thanks. Not an extra question, but just that gives me some hope. Thanks.
Representative Nagyak.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Chairman, mm-hmm. Thank you. So you're talking about $3 billion for 3 years? If you opt out or you don't do anything, the first year you lose that billion, and the second year you opt out, or you don't make a decision that you lose that that's $2 billion? Is that how it's going, or?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Nagyak, the 100% reimbursement from the federal government will be offered in the calendar years of 2014, 2015, and 2016. And so any states that either choose not to expand, delay the expansion, expand and then pull it back, as Representative Keller suggested, those are fixed in time. There's not going to be any extension in the in years down the road. Because starting in 2017, we begin that sliding scale from 100% down to 90%.
But what you're talking about, you were talking about a billion or $3 billion. What did I hear that right? Or I don't know where I have.
It's been a long day.
You were talking about billions a year or something.
Slide 19.
Yeah.
And maybe I could ask a question would help. How much the 138% has been calculated, right? And how many actual dollars per year we're talking about in the big picture, and what 10% is versus 100% or 90% when it's compared to 100%.
Representative Keller, through the chair, we're still working on those actuarial analysis and getting our head around exactly what that means in terms of actual numbers. There's been several studies that have been published. There's been a study from the Urban Institute that did an analysis and an estimate of what those costs may be, which is great because we're taking all of the information that's out there to make this decision. We're not using one report. We're not using two reports. We're using it all. And so those exact numbers, there's a range, and I'd be happy to provide that to you. But in terms of trying to nail it down, I don't know if we'll ever be able to do that truly accurately.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like everyone, right? A lot of questions here. But I've warmed up to the Affordable Care Act. Wasn't sure how I felt initially, but heard from small business owners about the need for something, and then also the prevention services. And I just want to make two quick comments. There's a PBS documentary for anyone who's listening or other members on the implementation and drafting of the bill shows how the pharmaceutical industry was really involved in that because, of course, they stand to gain when more people have access to prescription drugs. So that was just one point. And just the federal poverty level for Alaska at about 138% would be about $40,000 for a family of four. So just so that number's kind of in our head, I was just wondering about what that would be, about $40,000 for a family of four. So with that, I just want to focus back on the Medicaid expansion a little bit. And I'm wondering, I just came across a Washington Post article from March 9th, and I apologize, I wish I'd shared it with committee members and Will, but talks about Arkansas has now applied for sort of a waiver situation with Medicaid expansion, the first one that I guess is being considered by the federal government. And it's so new, I don't know if you'd have had an opportunity to consider the scenario there. Just for the committee members, suggesting instead of doing the Medicaid expansion, the state of Arkansas will use that money to buy private health insurance for the 200,000 people who would have been covered. So any thoughts on that as to whether that might be something Alaska would consider?
Representative Tarr, through the chair, I'm glad you brought that up. And so I've had several conversations with the Director of Health and Social Services in the state of Arkansas since they made that announcement. And we have asked them to share with us anything and everything that they have in that regard, because it's a very interesting prospect. But what I can tell you is that there's nothing in writing right now. They have a verbal agreement with Secretary Sebelius, and they're working out the details. And I think the devil is going to be in those details. But if this action is a sign of increased flexibility on behalf of the federal government, I believe that Alaska, along with several other states, will be very excited to look at those potential opportunities. And maybe not that one specifically, maybe some sort of derivative of that. But if that means the federal government is beginning to look at more than just an all or nothing proposition, which is what we've been told, is that it's all or nothing. If they're beginning to introduce some flexibility into that equation, that I think will be welcome news.
Thank you. Well, that's exciting that you're already talking to those folks and working together. I'll pass this around.
Representative Seaton, we're back at you.
Thanks. And I guess I've been contacted by constituents, and, you know, I've got two hospitals in my district and all that kind of stuff, and they are, you know, supportive of Medicaid expansion because they are suffering under the only people that pay now for those people that don't have insurance are Alaskans. I mean, it's, you go in the hospital and it's charity care, or you go in and it's increasing the cost to everyone, whether you're self-pay or whether you have insurance. And so I guess I'm trying to figure out, when we talk about the cost to rescind something, we're basically saying we're going to shift those costs back only to Alaskans instead of having some federal Medicaid dollars. I mean, either that or people don't get treated until they're very sick, and then the costs are up as well. Is that part of this mix that we're looking at as far as cost sharing and who's going to pay?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, in terms of cost sharing, I think, and maybe I'm a little bit unclear as to what you mean by rescind. I know that in our discussion we talked about expanding Medicaid and possibly pulling it back. If that's what you're talking about, then I think the issue of deciding to make to expand Medicaid and then going through that process, and then suddenly at a point sometime in the future, say when we go from 100% down the sliding scale of reimbursement to 90%, to make a decision to say, well, we're going to pull that expansion back, I think the first decision is actually going to be easier than the second. I agree with Representative Keller. I think the political decision to pull back is going to be much more difficult because of those issues specifically about how does that cost, these people, the group of people who would be covered one day and suddenly not covered the next day, I think would be very difficult to put together.
And just follow up, I guess the conversations I have it hasn't been with people that would get the coverage and then would lose the coverage, just the people that would have to pay all the hospital charity care and the increased costs, because there isn't any cost sharing if we would rescind at that point in time. So I guess you're looking at it from that aspect as well.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Seaton, going into the decision, we're looking at everything. Okay. I mean, it's really a multifaceted question, one that doesn't seem to have any end at this point. I mean, as I'm sure you're well aware, the Medicaid program touches a lot of what we do in the state in terms of healthcare delivery.
Thanks. Representative Reinbold.
Okay, I'm going to go back to the new fees and taxes, where there's a 2.3% sales tax on medical medical devices, a 3.8% Medicare tax on unearned income, a increase from 1.45 to 2.35 on individuals earning more than $200,000 and couples $250,000. A tax deduction is eliminated for those employers receiving Medicare Part D, and an $8 billion annual fee on the health insurance industry increasing over time. I guess to me, if I look at this for face value, it seems like it's hurting successful couples, businesses, and really going to penalize those people, older people who need medical devices. I mean, I'm just alarmed. I'm getting much colder towards this plan than I ever imagined. Never liked it, but it's making it much more, unattractive. I want to know, one, who are all these fees paying to? Are they getting paid to the federal government? So this is just a grab, of money and power and control of something that's so powerfully important, to us. So one, I want to know who is paying these fees, and is it true that those that passed this legislation, including one of our senators, exempted themselves from this plan? And I would like to know every single exemption of who's exempted themselves from this plan.
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, the taxes are being levied by the federal government, so they're being paid to the federal government. And in terms of a list of who's exempted, I'd be happy to put that together for you and get that to your office.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. Representative Pruitt?
Yeah. No, I will ask a question. It's related to, of course, it looks like 52,000 more last year would be covered, but I just want to make sure I'm reading appropriately. There is already an expectation that many companies will no longer provide insurance. Is that correct? Is that a good assessment that it's a lot of companies or businesses will either not do them or limit them?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, there is in groups of people who have nothing else to do but talk about this amongst themselves. Masochists, really. There's a lot of talk about what people will do once it becomes time for implementation. And the fact is, we don't know how people are going to act. We don't know how premiums are going to change going into 2014. And I think that will tell us a lot of how people are going to act moving forward. For example, if you're a small business and suddenly your premiums have gone up 20%, that changes your decision-making considerably, I would think. So there's a lot of pieces still needing to be clarified before you can say a lot of businesses are going to suddenly drop their employees' coverage. I think the Act assumes that businesses won't do that. There'll be a percentage, but in mass, they won't do that. And I think business owners don't want to do that. But I don't think they have enough information today to say what they're going to do in January of next year. And that's kind of the one of the major unknowns that makes analysis of whether this is going to be good or bad, whether this is doable or undoable, makes that analysis almost impossible, because we're still waiting on some of these data points that are going to make that decision happen or not happen.
Thank you. And can I have one follow-up? We're kind of in that same vein, but a little bit different. Of course, in our state, we have a substantial amount of people who are under either state or federal health care plans, working for the state, working for the federal government. How are they affected? Obviously, they've currently got good insurance. What impact will they see through all of this?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, are you asking about the individuals, or are you talking about the governments and the large?
Not the governments, but the individuals. I ask that just because there's so many people that either work for the state or their family member or however it is. There's just so many people that the state covers. I think when we were doing last year, we were talking about a particular insurance mandate. We were only talking about being able to mandate it on 17% of the insured people out there. The state was way bigger than that, and the majority of people we couldn't apply it to because they were, like I was at the time, I worked for a multinational corporation that was under the federal regulations. So, but it seemed to be that there was this massive amount of state employees in there that I'm just curious how they'll potentially be impacted, because I would estimate they'd be under a Cadillac plan, and that could... I'm just curious is that the only thing that we're looking at in that case, or will you see states start to find other ways of cutting costs by maybe merging their plans with Medicaid? I don't know. I'm just trying. Are there other ways that we're going to start seeing states start to pool maybe their own employees?
Representative Pruitt, through the chair. I'd have to find the exact section, but I know that several state plans, state employee plans, won't be affected immediately by the Affordable Care Act. The intent of the act was to kind of maintain all the insurance that's there right now and add to it. And for example, that's one of the reasons the Cadillac plans aren't touched until 2018, that tax regime there. But I think what you'll see in terms of state-covered employees, I don't think you'll see any change, certainly not in the short term, because a lot of what happens in the act happens in our state on that 17%.
Okay. Thank you.
In the interest of time, I've been asked by some – I know some committee members have to leave at 5, and others have asked if we can hang around for another 5 minutes or so to talk. And my suggestion would probably be we bring it back, because I know we have more than 5 minutes of questions to ask you. And I know we had talked earlier in the day, and you said you guys would be more than welcome to come back and sit with the committee and answer more questions. So I guess, as a discussion with the committee, do we want to ask some more questions, or should we just bring them back again? I know. We all. I've got questions I want to ask right now too. But
I want to bring them back. But I want to say I know how busy both of them are, and I really appreciate that they would take time to do it. And I do want them to come back. But for the record, there is something that Representative Tarr said that I just, and I need either correct it in my head or correct it on the record. But a family of four in Alaska federal poverty rates. I was wondering if either one of you know what that number is. What would be the eligibility at 138%? Traditional family of four, I think, is what.
Representative Keller, through the chair. I actually brought a table, and the numbers that Representative Tarr were citing, I think, were right on. So we were looking at the 138%. For a family of four, and this is from the 2013 Federal Poverty Guidelines for Alaska, is $40,627.
And for everybody's information here, that's about 70% of the average income in the state of Alaska. I've looked that up, so everyone kind of understands that.
Thank you.
So, obviously we're going to bring it back. Okay. there's way more questions, but we have time to go over it, and I know that you've been here all day and we've been here all day, we're going to get with you. We'll find a date that'll work for you to come back. We'll try to get you back for the next couple weeks, if that would be okay, while it's still fresh in everyone's mind, and maybe we can get more time with you and because, there's a lot of questions. But I appreciate you coming in and trying to explain it to us. I know there's a lot of questions you can't answer, but it helps us when we're able to talk to our constituents about it, because it's a hot topic item out there. Everybody wants to know what's going on, and it's just hard to explain it to people because we just don't know. And that's what I tell them. I says, I don't know. It's changing every day. I hear something new. So we appreciate you coming in.
Mr. Chairman, and certainly I'm available. Should any member have any specific questions, please don't hesitate to contact us, especially if it's constituent-driven. We're happy to get to those as quickly as we can to make sure, even if you don't know, you can give them some background on
I certainly will.
We can help you with.
I'll try my best. Okay, with that, our next HES committee meeting will be at 3 p.m. on Tuesday, March 19th. At that time, we're going to hear House Bill 134, Medicaid Payment for MediSet Prescription. It is now 5:03 p.m., and we are adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.